Good morning, Chief Justice and Justices. I'm Edward McNally for the appellant, Albert Poliak. As I began to rise for this argument, the batteries in my hearing aid went off. So I will tend to speak up, but if I ask the court to repeat, I regret the fact that I don't have the best of hearing. I also, in looking over the briefs here, recognize that I did not do a good job in simplifying the facts. And I think the facts can be simplified in a way that really highlights what is the most important issue or issues in this case. So let me begin for just a minute or two by trying to simplify those facts. On May the 2nd, 2011, the potential investors of ARC were about to pay $3 million to acquire the Series A preferred stock. What did they know, and what did Mr. Poliak know, and what did Mr. Keyser know? And what did the other plaintiffs know on that day? They knew that since December of 2010, there had been a dispute over whether Mr. Poliak had properly authorized the issuance to himself of the Series B preferred. They knew that after some negotiations in January of 2011, the parties had entered into a confidential settlement agreement where all of their disputes were to be resolved. They knew that on March 31 of 2011, ARC and Exxon had entered into a notes agreement which contained a broad release, but which also provided that Mr. Keyser was reserving his rights as a stockholder. They knew that the subscription agreement had been circulated in April. All of the plaintiffs in this case had that agreement. They all understood that it said that Mr. Poliak would continue to control ARC and his management team would run ARC. They knew that on April 19th, Keyser was told he must sign off on his issues with Poliak or there would not be a deal. The letter says, this is from ARC's attorney to Mr. Keyser's attorney, the major remaining issue is the sale of Keyser's interest in ARC. Many of the investors want to know that the issue related to Mr. Keyser's interest in ARC have been resolved prior to funding their investment. And they knew after April 19, when the deal closing was delayed, that Mr. Keyser's lawyer had said, I'm going to file a 225 case if you don't make this deal happen. And they knew that 3 days before May the 2nd, on April 29, 2011, Mr. Keyser had made the issue go away by signing a settlement agreement that said he would sell his stock to ARC, thereby divesting himself of any ability to contest the issuance of the preferred stock to Mr. Poliak. On May the 2nd, the investors, Mr. Poliak, Mr. Keyser, completed the investment. Mr. Keyser walked away with $400,000. All of the plaintiffs benefited from that because otherwise ARC was bankrupt. The creditors would have put it out of business, and all of the plaintiffs in this case wanted that settlement to close. They stood by and let $3 million be invested in ARC under the circumstances I just outlined.
Well, are you suggesting that any of the facts as found by the Chancellor or Vice Chancellor are clearly wrong or clearly erroneous?
Yes, I am. That's the heart of my argument.
Okay, and which particular findings?
The finding that we say is critical to the logic of the court's opinion is the finding that investors did not rely upon the management of ARC and Mr. Poliak's control of ARC at the time they put up their $3 million. I think the court's finding on that point is the pivotal finding in this case. Had the court found that the investors did rely upon Poliak's control, the court must have found that they were prejudiced by the change in position and the delay of Keyser in not presenting that issue to a court or to them prior to the time Keyser took their money.
Help us find that in the record. You alluded to it a moment ago, but in the briefs we get from your opponent, they say there were no witnesses that were called that testified to that effect.
That's incorrect. And it's so incorrect that I'm going to spend a couple of minutes explaining why. To begin with, I asked each of the plaintiffs who testified whether or not Mr. Poliak's control of ARC was important to investors. Mr. Keyser, on page A222 of the record, says it was a, quote, big concern of investors. Mr. Shark, Mr. Salvatore, also testified that they expected investors would be told that because it's a material fact to them. What did Mr. Curtis testify? He said, when you're buying into a company, especially a small cap company or a young growing company, the most important thing that you're betting on your money on that management team. And he put up $250,000 on that bet. He convinced his best clients to put up $1.4 million on the reliance of the management team.
Excuse me, what page is that?
That I just quoted, Justice Berger, is on page of the appendix. It begins on 469, and the heart of it is at 472 to 473. Sheck and Poliak testified that they went on a roadshow for the express purpose of convincing the investors to be comfortable with management. And, of course, the offering materials all referred to this because it was material to investors. The court's finding to the contrary, I will argue, is both not based on any facts, let alone substantial facts, and is illogical. When you read the appellee's brief, there is no citation to anything contrary to what I just said in the record. There is no testimony that people put up $3 million and they don't care who runs the company. Nobody testified to that.
Now, the Court of Chancery also said in its opinion that some investors might have thought having a controlling shareholder was detrimental. What's the basis for the Court of Chancery saying that?
Justice Holland, there is no basis. That appears to be the opinion of Vice Chancellor. There is not a single thing in the record that supports that opinion. I suggest it's contrary to common experience, it's illogical, and it's contrary to every investment management book we've ever read. But most importantly, this case should be decided on this record. It shouldn't be decided on the philosophical views of the Vice Chancellor about what investors like or they don't like. That's outside the record. It's a remark that is critical to his holding, but it's totally unsupported by the record or logic. And therefore, I meet in this case the difficult burden of the showing that the finding of fact is just simply incorrect and ought to be reversed.
Are you suggesting that if what the Vice Chancellor found was on the record, that we would still have to find that it's legally insufficient? The reason I'm reacting to your comment about the finding being, not in the record and contrary to logic. Do you really mean that?
I absolutely do. It's clearly contrary to the record, and I do believe it's not a logical conclusion that you can reach, even though there's nothing in the record to support it. I guess I pointed out, I think in our brief, now today, all of the testimony is that who controls a small company is important when somebody puts their money up. All the plaintiffs so testified. The Poliak testified. Shark testified. The record is clear that the investors had material told them that because it was material to them. And it seems to us that, when I read the appellee's brief, there's not a single citation to any place in the record that supports the contrary conclusion. Not one. Now, for latches to apply, of course, there's standard rule is that you have to have knowledge of the facts and the law. There has to be unreasonable delay and prejudice. The last two components, unreasonable delay and prejudice, have a tendency to mesh together. But there's really no longer any dispute that all of the plaintiffs had knowledge that they needed to file suit in early 2011 if they wanted to stop the issuance of the Series A preferred. Chancery Court said they all knew what was going on. They all had knowledge. Indeed, Mr. Keyser had his lawyer write a letter saying he was going to sue unless his demands were met. I hope there is a dispute over whether their delay was unreasonable. Now, this is why I think it's so important to focus on the facts that I tried to articulate at the beginning. Keyser signed the settlement agreement 3 days before the money was transferred. ARC had every reason to rely on his contractual obligation to sell his stock. But he later repudiated that agreement, but Keyser himself testified on page A218 of the record that it was his understanding, if this basic plan of involving all of the elements of the settlement were carried out, that would settle all the disputes. That's what everybody believed on May the 2nd when the money was transferred. If he didn't want them to believe that, he had to do something about it, and he didn't. Now, as to prejudice, the Fike versus Rugger case points out, it's just not prejudice to Poliak. It's prejudice to the rights of third parties that can trigger a Latches defense and support a Latches defense. Here, that element is satisfied. The record only supports the conclusion that the third-party investors bought Series A preferred stock believing that Poliak not only controlled ARC, but that he would continue to control ARC. Let's think about the contrary.
But there was no testimony by any third-party investor to that effect, was there?
Mr. Curtis is an investor. He's not a third-party investor, Justice Jacobs. I understand that.
So the testimony that to that effect was self-serving at the least, wasn't it?
I think so. I think it's self-serving. Now, when a person testifies and offers self-serving testimony, you don't discredit it just because it's self-serving. You discredit it only if it seems contrary to the logic and the other facts in the case. Curtis's testimony is totally supported by the logic and the facts of the case.
I want to
emphasize this again.
There's a rule of law that a trial judge can't reject testimony simply because it's self-serving?
There is no such rule of law. I agree with you, Justice Jacobs. So if we take out Mr. Curtis's testimony, throw it away, what are we left with? The testimony of the plaintiffs, because this was an important fact. The fact of the matter is that there's a letter to Keyser from ARC's lawyer saying, if you don't settle up, there's no deal. The investors, and that's the quote, the investors want you to settle this before they're going to put their money up. And, of course, there is all the offering memorandum that say this is an important fact. So I don't rest my case, my argument, on Mr. Curtis's testimony, although significantly the Court of Chancery did not say it discredited Mr. Curtis's testimony. There's nothing in the opinion that says it rejected the testimony. It simply skips over it. It ignores it. Now, it seems to us that Delaware law ought to be, and we think it's grounded in all the way back in the 1940 case of Federal United Corp. versus Havender, that when the capital structure of a company is going to be affected by a transaction, people with a claim who know all that and are going to know that people are relying on what's going to happen, they have to speak up. They have to file a lawsuit or they're going to be guilty of Latches. It's that intervening event that makes Latches appropriate, notwithstanding that 3 years haven't gone by. Here, Keyser and all the investors thought he had settled his claims. He knew that. And yet he proceeded, he sat silent. That has to have a consequence. It has to have a consequence. If people are entitled to rely upon the capital structure of a Delaware corporation, these investors knew they were going to be Series A, Series B, common stock, put their money in on that basis. That has to have the delay here has to have that consequence. Now, we also rely, apart from Latches, on the doctrines of ratification, acquiescence, and waiver as set out in our brief. Now, clearly, Keyser and the other plaintiffs benefited from the sale of the Series A preferred stock. That can't be disputed. Keyser got $400,000 out of it. All the other plaintiffs had their bankrupt company saved and their investment in that company preserved for whatever value it might have in the future. They can't argue that it didn't benefit them. What they did argue, and what the court below seemed to accept, is that the transaction that counted was the issuance of the Series B preferred stock to Poliak. And unless they somehow benefited when Poliak sold the stock to himself, that they weren't barred by ratification, acquiescence, or waiver. Now, we suggest that argument, which is there has to be a literal quid pro quo, simply ignores the facts here. It ignores the reality. The reality is that after this dispute arose in the beginning of 2011, Poliak and his team went out there and sold this company based on Poliak's control and his management team. The Series A stock never would have been sold but for the fact that Keyser signed the settlement agreement and the other plaintiffs went along with the sale. We say that that is ratification or acquiescence, and therefore their claims are barred. Now, with that, I do want to reserve some time for rebuttal, but if the court has any questions, I'm happy to hear them.
I do. The Vice Chancellor said in the subscription agreement, Poliak's control is disclosed in bold, under the bold heading, risks relating to this offering, which suggests that obviously it's a risk as opposed to a particular benefit. What's your response?
That's a sort of clever play in some respects by the Vice Chancellor on the word risk. A risk in an investment is that something that you need to be aware of and take careful account of in deciding to invest, so that if you invest in this company, the risk you bear is that Poliak turns out to be a lousy manager and that there's nothing you can do about it, investors, because Poliak is in control of the company because he has this Series B preferred stock. That's the risk. So you have to rely upon, when you make this investment, on the Poliak team. That's the risk you run. And don't think you can change that, investors, because you're stuck with this team. That's what that risk means. And that's why it supports Poliak's argument here that the investors relied upon his management team.
So it says you're stuck with this team in some perhaps more legalistic way in the subscription agreement?
Yes. And the other side argues, and the Vice Chancellor said, well, the team can change. Every time an investor makes an investment, she focuses on what are the facts at the time I make my investment. Sure, things can change. Poliak could die. Something else could happen to the company. But investors take the company as it is and its prospects when they make that investment. The fact that something can change years from now, that Steve Jobs can die at Apple, all that stuff can happen. That's a risk, but it doesn't mean that they don't rely on the facts as they exist as of the day they make their investment. Of course they do. And to say that maybe those facts could change later means they don't care what the current facts are seems to me to be illogical. And therefore, the heart of the opinion below is based on findings that are not supported by any of the facts, not just substantial facts, any of the facts, and it, quite frankly, is contrary to logic, and therefore should be reversed.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. Mike Pittenger from Potter, Anderson, and Caroon on behalf of plaintiffs below, appellees Robert Keyser, Frank Salvatore, and Scott Schulk. Also seated at council table with me today is my colleague Ryan Costa. I'd like to start where Mr. McNally did, but maybe a little bit earlier, on the facts, because I do think that the April-May facts are the nub of the issue here. Stepping back even further than that, though, I completely disagree that you, in applying equitable defenses, can ignore what the underlying conduct was. I think we have to take account here that the underlying conduct was egregious, because equitable defenses assume that you've met the elements of your claim, but that for some principle of equity outweighs that, and it involves balancing and it involves discretion. The underlying conduct here back in December of 2010 was Mr. Poliak knew a group of stockholders was getting ready to remove him. He adopted supermajority Series B preferred stock, 1,000 votes a share, giving himself outright voting control of the company by far. He's the sole director. He does this in a very hurried process. The terms of that stock, redeemable next day, $1 per share, at his option as the stockholder, issues them to himself for a penny per share, absolute control of this company for $250 for the admitted purpose of preventing stockholders from removing him. He admits that. This is not a case where he made it mathematically more difficult. He made it mathematically impossible. He was preclusive. Not surprisingly, the Court of Chancery found that was an egregious breach of the duty of loyalty. And unwound the stock issuance, found that the consent that was signed a year later in December 2011 was a valid consent to elect a new board. That decision on the duty of loyalty has not been appealed. Only the equitable defense decision is appealed.
And the equitable defenses are waiver, estoppel, and latches.
Latches, ratification, acquiescence, right. And they all run together. They're all based on getting to the facts that Mr. McNally started with. This, did Series A investors rely? Who did when?
If I understand it correctly, your position is to the extent that prejudice is an element of these defenses, there wasn't any. The court correctly so found that there was no unreasonable delay. Certainly what happened here took place well within the limitations period, and there was no waiver because all the rights in question had been preserved. Have I missed something?
You are not missing anything at all, and that might be a good way to get to what happened in April. And I think for that we need to look at the fact that we had an agreement with a company called Auxil. Mr. Keyser's not a party to that agreement. At the end of March, to repurchase Auxil's securities. ARC and Mr. Poliak decided to have two separate purchases, one of the Auxil securities and a separate purchase of the securities, the stock that Mr. Keyser held personally for a long time. When you get into April, ARC and Mr. Poliak had defaulted on the agreement to repurchase the Auxil securities. Mr. Keyser has me send a letter threatening litigation, saying that the Series B preferred stock was all a breach of an egregious breach of duty and the like, and threatening litigation. There was a letter that came after that from counsel to Mr. Poliak and ARC saying, if you sue, it's going to really disrupt the Series A offering. We won't be able to close the Auxil purchase. Keep in mind, there's no agreement at this time to purchase Mr. Keyser's shares. What Mr. McNally doesn't talk about is the next letter, which is it's an email, actually, A1315-16 in the appendix. And it's interesting what that letter said. It's from Knox Bell after the letter from Locke Lord that says, hey, if you sue, this won't happen. Mr. Bell says, in a long paragraph, Mr. Poliak has breached his fiduciary duties in every way imaginable. We're not giving up on that. Parties are still interested, though, in settling. There had been an allegation in the Locke Lord letter saying, you know, if you sue, we might have to do a supplemental disclosure. Mr. Bell, I think, scratching his head, saying, what do you mean supplemental disclosure? Stockholders don't know about this stuff? Or the possible investors don't know about these claims? He puts in his email, quote, and this is on the 19th of April, in any event, ARC should be fully informing its investors of the relevant facts and not trying to keep true facts secret. This was Mr. Poliak's disclosure. Not Mr. Keyser's disclosure, not Mr. Salvador's or Schulk's disclosure to the Series A investors. May I get a glass of water?
Who were the outside investors again?
I believe they were people who held notes and converted, and I believe there were other investors, too, who were asked to purchase, and I think they were friends, acquaintances, business acquaintances.
And the outside investment was to the tune of what, $200,000? Dollars?
I'm not sure. I think it was more than that. I think it might have been several million.
And what does the record show that they knew or didn't know at the time that they made their investment?
Well, in retrospect, there was no disclosure in the offering materials that Mr. Poliak and his team prepared. And apparently Mr. Poliak and his team never disclosed that there was this claim about the the stock. Keep in mind that when the parties did then enter into, jumping back, that March agreement had that language, for the avoidance of doubt, as long as Keyser owns his 7 million original shares, he's preserving all rights and claims. Everyone knew what that meant. When they then
you say everyone, including the outside investors?
Well, the outside investors didn't get that. I think that's very interesting. If you look at the draft of the agreement that Mr. Poliak sent to these outside investors in the offering materials, and I apologize, I don't know the page, but the draft's attached, oddly doesn't have that provision in it. Doesn't have the provision that says for the avoidance of doubt. I don't think anyone's ever figured out why. Just not there. I think they might have gone out before that provision came in or something like that, but he never corrected it. Speaking of never correcting, and this goes to the point about Mr. Curtis relying. He bought shares, too, at the end of November. There was another offering of A. And by the end of November, things had changed pretty drastically. Mr. Keyser had given his notice to terminate the Keyser settlement. He and Mr. Schalk and Mr. Salvatore had put in to the record at the annual meeting, had it read into the record, an objection to the Series B preferred stock. By the way, Mr. Salvatore and Mr. Schalk had a vague notion earlier in the year that Mr. Poliak had done something to prevent his removal. But they didn't find out about the Series B until they got the notice of that annual meeting in the fall. And that's why they put these notes in, and that's why they started working with Mr. Keyser in the fall. Mr. Keyser and Mr. Salvatore and Schalk weren't working together the whole time, especially through this January through April period, as Mr. Poliak and his counsel would have the court believe. They started working together in October, and I've seen nothing suggesting that any of these equitable defenses apply to Schalk and Salvatore. But jumping back to what you know in November, they had given an objection at the annual meeting, and they had sent a voting agreement to the company saying, we are going to vote to elect a new board because we think those Series B shares are invalid. The company thereafter does another offering of Series A, does not tell these investors about this claim. So it's hard for me to believe today that Mr. Poliak and his cronies believed that this is somehow something that should have been disclosed to the investors. And if they did, they're the ones that failed to disclose it. Mr. Keyser and his counsel said, you better be disclosing in that email all the material facts. It's not their fault that they didn't do it. They had no control over the offering materials. They weren't allowed to see them. I think another very, very important fact is...
Well, how does the duty to disclose, even if that's right, relate to whether or not there's latches?
Well, I don't believe it does, because another important fact, we're not trying to disrupt and undo the Series A investment here. Mr. McNally mentioned we're trying to disrupt the capital structure. The only thing that happened was the Series B stock was invalidated. The Series A stock, we're not trying to invalidate. We believe was duly authorized. That's another very important point, the argument about latches and ratification, and it all works together, an unreasonable delay, that it somehow allowed him...
Mr. Pittenger, yes. Just to follow up on Justice Ridgely's question, sure. Because I had the same one, we know that the issue or issues that we need to decide are whether the trial judge properly found that there was no latches, acquiescence, estoppel, and whatever other equitable defenses were raised. We also know, because Mr. McNally has told us, that key to that set of issues is a single factual finding, namely the finding by the court that investors, the public investors, did not rely on Poliak's control when making the investment. Now, I think it's that argument that we'd like you to respond to. And whatever else bears on the equitable defenses.
Sure. That argument, the court specifically found on page 44 that defendants have not shown that Series A purchasers bought shares because they believe Poliak would forever have control of ARC. It's a factual finding based on the burden of proof. By the way, the defendants obviously here bear the burden of proof.
And the argument is there's no evidence to support that finding and it doesn't make any sense. What is your response?
The evidence that it doesn't make any sense for them to not rely for
the argument is there's no evidence to support the finding. And secondly, even if there was, the finding makes no sense, no logical sense.
I think you have to, they're turning things on its head here a little bit. The burden was on them to prevent evidence that the Series A investors relied. They tried to put some self-serving testimony in, and there were some questions of Mr. McNally about that. But there's a doctrine that when you have weak evidence, or I would say self-serving evidence, when stronger evidence is available, i.e. the testimony of one of these investors saying, I really relied on this, that's not, the evidence just isn't very powerful. And what the court found was that they had not presented enough evidence to convince the court that they had carried their burden of proving that investors relied. It was all inference and innuendo. And then in their opening brief, they say it was our burden to prove that investors don't care. Well, of course investors care who's there now.
Did your side put in any contrary evidence with respect to what the investors cared about?
We did not.
So the entire record is the testimony that says it did matter to us.
Well, none of them said that other than Mr. Curtis.
What does the record show about the investors' knowledge of the settlement? There seems to be this exchange of correspondence that says, and we need to get this settled. It's of concern to the investors. And does the record show that the investors were made aware of a settlement?
The record shows that Mr. Poliak misrepresented the nature of the settlement. Not Mr. Keyser, Mr. Poliak. He didn't tell him about that provision that said Mr. Keyser's reserving his rights for as long as he owns the stock. I don't know why. It's bizarre.
Why was it necessary for Mr. Keyser to renounce the settlement, so to speak, if he had a reservation of rights? What was he renouncing?
I'm not sure I follow the question. Do you mean the argument that he should have renounced the settlement and stopped because he knew somebody was lying to the investors?
Well, what was accomplished with the settlement if there was this broad reservation of rights? What would anybody think the settlement accomplished if they knew about the reservation of rights?
It removed a very significant stockholder, repurchased debt that stockholder had, Auxil, and was part and parcel of this recapitalization where they were issuing Series A preferred and buying in the securities held by that very significant stockholder. Mr. Keyser was an affiliate of that stockholder, and the release language covered affiliates, and that's why it was necessary to put for the avoidance of doubt in it, because he also separately held his 7 million shares. And frankly,
so your position is, since Keyser was affiliated with the entity involved in the settlement, lest there be any confusion, everyone was put on notice that it was the corporate entity that was reaching a settlement, but not Keyser in his individual capacity.
That's correct. There were two different settlements, and in the separate settlement, he included the language that we have in our briefs that by entering into this agreement, there's no waiver of claims. And that agreement also said that once the stock is repurchased, then he's surrendering all of his rights, et cetera, to the company. And the court below found that that stock has not been repurchased, still owned by Mr. Keyser. That fact has not been appealed. In addition to that, even if the Court of Chancery would have said that stock should be deemed repurchased, it couldn't be voted because the company would own it. And there was enough stock, and there were findings on this in the Court of Chancery's opinion too, there was enough stock voted in the December 2011 consent to elect the new board anyway, remove the other directors and elect the new board anyway. And keeping in mind that Mr. Salvatore and Mr. Schalk were not parties to the Auxil stock and no purchase agreement settlement or the Keyser settlement, I haven't heard anything about what they supposedly did other than they waited too long. I did want to, another argument that they've made is that.
Just so yes. I'm clear about the investors who did not testify, they apparently, were they reasonably available for both sides?
I think they were, I believe they were business acquaintances, friends, colleagues of the people that were controlling then, Mr. Poliak, Mr. Curtis, Mr. Hans. I'm not absolutely sure of that, but that's my understanding. And Mr. McNally mentioned, for example, that Mr. Curtis encouraged one of his biggest clients to buy the stock. So they were all people that that group knew. And
well, doesn't that support the argument that if they were friends of Poliak, they thought they were investing in his continued management?
I don't believe so. I don't believe anyone can reasonably believe, even if there's a controlling stockholder, that they're going to control forever. And it was almost, you know, it was 9 months before this consent was dropped to elect a new board, keeping in mind that Mr. Poliak wasn't on the board anymore. He was under investigation by FINRA when all this offering was happening and subsequently was made to step down for a period of time. So he wasn't even on the board anymore. So they certainly could not have been relying on him being there. You know, maybe they thought he had a control block of stock, but he could have sold it. They could have issued more stock to other people. But more importantly, why didn't he disclose to these investors this record that Mr. Keyser had made these claims, that Mr. Keyser had carefully, in contracts, reserved rights until all this is done, until his shares are purchased, he's reserving his claim. And if we don't get around to purchasing those shares, he has his claims. And another, they keep saying this company's insolvent. They can't. How are they going to repurchase Mr. Keyser's claims in November if the company's insolvent? And you know, the valuation showed the common stock worth zero. The contract said they had to pay at least $50,000. Section 160 doesn't let you purchase stock back in that circumstance. That's why Mr. Keyser reserved his rights. Yes, sir.
Mr. Pettinger, on the assumption that this, the nub of the factual argument is the significance of the motivation for the investors as it relates to who's controlling the company, what facts support the vice chancellor's comment? I'm going to say comment because it's not clear to me yet whether it's a finding of fact, a holding, or dicta, or what it is, that investors might find, to the effect that investors might find it chilling to invest in a company where there's a controlling stockholder. What's the genesis of that?
I believe that, and I don't know that it's a factual finding, as you suggest, as much as based on the vice chancellor's experience, the fact that it was in the risk factor section, as Justice Ridgely pointed out, and the vice chancellor's experience that controlling stockholders are not always viewed as a good thing. There was argument in the opening brief that.
How does a litigator confront a comment along those lines where a judge, to quote one of my colleagues who recently used this term, which I could claim it for myself, the vice chancellor's worldview as opposed to what the facts are in the record? How does a litigator confront that? Where does it, when it comes like some mythological beast out of his head and it's suddenly there, how would you expect that to be said or why in the absence of any facts to support it? His experience doesn't tell you anything.
I think that we are fortunate here. I don't think that was the driving force behind it. I think
well,
the
that's my question.
Was that, but I agree with you.
The way the argument difficult. Was posited earlier on, it was important because we've been, my colleagues, by their questions and my view, have been exploring what is the factual record to support a conclusion one way or another about the significance of the expertise of the majority stockholder that would entice investors to invest or turn them off.
No.
That seems to be something everyone wants to talk about, but now you're telling me it's really not that significant.
I don't think that was the. I think the basis was they didn't meet their burden of proof on the facts. I do believe that that clouds the issue a little bit, and I don't think that there wasn't scholarly articles cited or anything like
tell
that.
Tell us what is the controlling fact.
The controlling
found by the vice chancellor that's clearly supported by the record that says there is no basis for any of these affirmative equitable defenses.
The controlling facts are where he says that they did not meet their burden of proof. The controlling facts are the reasons for the delay. I want to point to page 45 and 46.
Well, they didn't meet their burden of proof is fine, but that's a generality. What did they have to prove that they did not prove?
They had to prove that investors relied on Poliak Controlling Forever and that my clients, all of them, were somehow responsible for the false disclosure that was apparently made to them that did not say to them, by the way, there's a stockholder who has a claim. And my clients, Mr. Keyser's not responsible for that, and even if he were, keep in mind, Mr. Schalk and Mr. Salvador didn't know they had a claim at this time. They didn't even know about the Series B preferred stock until October.
To ask the Chief Justice's question in a slightly different way,
sure.
If, in fact, as Mr. McNally argues, the outside investors did rely in making their investment on the continued control of Mr. Poliak, Mr. Poliak's being removed from control, at least control of the board after the investment, would signify that those investors had been misled, correct? Was there any testimony by an investor that he or she had been misled?
Only Mr. Curtis, who I think, again, you had asked earlier whether that's self-serving.
Was not an outside investor.
Also, he was not an outside investor, and what he did in November when he knew
about
the
answer is no, except for Mr. Curtis?
That's yes. There was no other evidence.
Did any investor file a lawsuit claiming that there had been some equitable misconduct or inequitable conduct, and therefore the court should rescind the investment?
Not to my knowledge, there have been no lawsuits filed. And
let me see if I understand where we are now. It appears that Poliak and Curtis brought these other investors forward. And we'll assume the other investors thought it was important that Poliak was going to stay in control. And your argument is Poliak should have told them his position was precarious. And if they'd have known that, maybe they wouldn't have invested. And the other side is saying that it wasn't clear that his position was precarious. So we're going to change the focus a little bit, but what's the state of the record with regard to Poliak's continued tenure at the time people made the investment?
Sure. I'm out of time, Your Honor. Can I answer as quickly as I possibly can?
Take all the time you want.
We have the letter from me in April saying you breached your duty, we challenged the Series B stock. We have the letter from Mr. Bell after that saying you breached your duty, you've challenged all this. We have one agreement that's already in place that says for the avoidance of doubt until those shares are done, Mr. Keyser's reserving all of his rights and claims. Everyone knew what that meant. We have the language when they actually entered into this Keyser settlement agreement at the end of April that says entering into this is not a waiver of claims. We're not done until we're done. Mr. Poliak knew.
That answers my question. So your point is that they put Poliak on notice, and to the extent he was letting people invest based on his continued tenure, the problem lies with him and not letting them know that that was in dispute.
Exactly, and even if Mr. Keyser did something wrong, there's no evidence of what Mr. Schalk and Mr. Salvatore did. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Before you begin, I would like to kind of pick up where the other side left off. There seems to be great emphasis on the idea that everybody knew, or at least the important players knew, that there was this reservation of rights to make a claim, and that therefore Mr. Poliak should have been telling everybody that, you know, yeah, there's a settlement agreement, but it doesn't mean anything because there's a reservation of rights. What's your response to that?
Justice Berger, I think that really does put the burden on the wrong person. It's certainly true that on April 19th, there was a letter saying the investors want the Keyser situation cleared up. There was a response to that letter saying, you should tell these people that we're going to sue. Then they signed the settlement. There's a contract signed. The contract says, we'll perform this contract. But by the way, if ARC doesn't perform the contract, I still have my rights. Now, whether the contract says that or doesn't say that, that's what the law is anyway. So once that contract was signed on April 29th, 3 days before the settlement, that removed the issue of whether or not Keyser was going to sue to oust Poliak because ARC intended to perform the contract. It was no longer an issue. Certainly, Keyser protected himself by saying, if you fail to perform, I'm reserving my rights. But there's nothing in that agreement that says I can still sue even while the contract's outstanding. That makes no sense. And let's focus on that a little bit more. The lawyer for ARC said that unless this is resolved, there's no deal. Keyser was getting, Justice Jacobs, is $2,200,000 in cash, not $200,000. Keyser was getting $400,000 in cash 3 days later. Now, does that mean that anybody sitting there at that table thought that Keyser was going to sue later unless if ARC tried to perform? Of course not. So I hope that answers your question. Now, let me turn a little bit to this issue of what is the testimony. In our brief, we tried to outline what we think is the supportive testimony from persons other than Curtis. But let me read that in effect to the investors relied. Now, one of the reasons, here are the questions on page A222. And this is in response to the whole dialogue about the letter from ARC's lawyer saying you're going to sue. And the response to that letter, and the question is, the answer is, he's saying that if we file a lawsuit, there's a likelihood that the agreement to satisfy the notes would be impossible and it would force the company into liquidation. Question, fair enough. You knew that just from your own experience that it was likely that potential investors would back out of their investment in light of the litigation, correct? I don't want to pretend to know what investors would do. Big concern, question. Yes, and one of the reasons it is a big concern is because investors in companies like this want to know who is on the management team, correct? Answer from Mr. Keyser, yes. Now, the rest of the dialogue is totally consistent with testimony that investors rely on who is on the management team. To say that it's all Curtis is simply not fair. Now, with respect to, I think I've covered the point about this April 19 email saying you should tell the investors and why that became moot because of the April 29 settlement agreement.
Just one question about that testimony. Is there any testimony that those investors detrimentally relied as opposed to relied?
I can't recall whether the word detrimental was used. I will tell Your Honor that every single plaintiff said all the investors want to know who's on the management team, and that's why they invest. I do not recall whether the word detrimental was used or whether I asked those questions, Justice Steele, because that's the point I wanted to make. To then get told later that doesn't make any difference because investors don't care is a total surprise.
Was there any document, letter, memorandum sent by an outside investor to any of the players complaining that they had been, these are my words, duped into making this investment because all of a sudden there was a bait and switch?
Most of these people put up, reasonably small amounts of money. Total was $2.2 million. It's hard to sue over your share of that. So I can't explain why they didn't, and they didn't. They're hopefully waiting the outcome of this litigation. Now, as to what the investors were told, the stock and note purchase agreement is part of the subscription materials. So they were told this deal involved paying off the notes held by Keyser and his colleagues. They were told that Keyser had reserved his rights, and I assume that when Keyser, that's not I assume, I know, that when Keyser signed the settlement agreement, that issue went away. It's just that simple.
They also were told that Poliak may take actions that may not be in the best interest of our other stockholders because he was the sole member of the board of directors and the principal stockholder, right?
Absolutely. They were told that. That's a risk that they were willing to run. Why? Because they wanted Poliak's management with Curtis and the others. That's why they invested. Does anybody think they would have invested this kind of money without being impressed by the management? It makes no sense. Now, I think that I've covered the points that I want to make with respect to the factual recitals by Mr. Pittenger, and I think he simply got the facts incorrect. Because, as I say, I think the testimony supports the point that the investors had did rely on what they were told. I think I've explained that the April 29 agreement mooted the issue of
Keyser
suing.
In terms of the availability of these investors as witnesses, they were more affiliated with your side than the other. Is that correct?
Well, I'm not sure I could go with the word affiliated, Justice, originally, but they were all from the Baltimore area. I mean, the honest answer is maybe I could have gotten them to come up here and testify. I probably could have. Be perfectly honest. If I had, they were clients of Curtis. Curtis is a broker. The record shows this. Curtis is a broker in Baltimore, Maryland. And that's where he gets his customers.
What does the record show was the basis for this litigation? You know, why did Keyser decide to bring the suit? He just didn't want Poliak running the company anymore?
I think the record shows that Keyser not only didn't want Poliak running the company anymore, but he, Salvatore, and Keyser wanted to get bought out at a price that Poliak wasn't going to pay. Remember the original agreements between the investors and Keyser. Those original agreements that caused Poliak to do what he did and seize control of the company. Those original agreements obligated Keyser to pay those three creditors more money than they were entitled to on a pro rata basis for all the other creditors. It was a flat-out agreement to loot ARC. Now, it's moot, but that's not part of this case. But that's what we're dealing with.
Thank you very much, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.